It's a question of access.
Well, you know, and the heels.
And so, okay. Today is Wednesday, February 18th. I call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. We're going to go a little out of order today. We are first going to have a public hearing on House Bill 2824, since we have a colleague here who needs to leave after this. And then we'll have our informational hearing on the Oregon Youth Authority, followed by a public hearing on House Bill 2031. Thank you for your understanding. While you're coming up, Robin, can we please have the summary of the bill?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2824 prohibits landlords from requiring tenants to declaw or devocalize animals allowed on premises, prohibits landlords from advertising available units so as to encourage declawing or devocalization, sets civil penalty at $1,000 per violation. There is no revenue impact. It may have a fiscal impact, though no statement has been issued. There is no subsequent referral.
Senator Barton.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brent Barton. I represent House District 40. And in my third term now, I believe this is the first time I've made my way to this committee. So it's nice to be here. Thank you for having me. House Bill 2824 is modeled on a bill that passed, I believe, unanimously from California. And it is essentially would prohibit conditioning tenancy on having a dog or cat debarked or declawed. Those procedures are increasingly out of favor and increasingly rare. And in my humble opinion, barbarous processes unless medically necessary. Debarking a dog generally involves a procedure that actually cuts the vocal cords of the dog. Declawing a cat is fairly invasive surgery that permanently affects the health of the cat. So that is the purpose of the bill, and okay. In fact, it is.
Representative Barton?
Yes, of course.
Just found out we are having a technical trouble with getting it hooked up to the audio. So we're going to stand at ease the recording for the public.
So you need to gather to stand at ease?
Standing at ease.
Cool. And Chair Kenny Geyer, would you like me to start over?
Yes, please.
Joke's on you guys. Sorry.
And we're going to really run today?
Yeah.
Can we just make small bands right here? Huh? Good.
Ask him what he thinks about my dog.
What do you think about her dog?
So, in fact,
should we decline back on?
Are we on or are they just trying
it? I think we are. Are we on now? Do we need to talk so you can see?
See, I'm reading your bio right now about your three dog bites, and I'm wondering how that factors into today's bill.
He's against declawing and debarking, but he's not against deteething or something.
Deteething.
Muzzles or whatever.
Yeah, right. Is it on? It's on?
We're good to go.
Okay.
There we go.
I'm going to start from the beginning. Today is Wednesday, February 18th. I call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. I want to tell everyone for the record that we're going to go a little out of order on today's agenda. We are going to first have a public hearing on House Bill 2824. Followed by an informational hearing on the Oregon Youth Authority, and then a public hearing on 2031. Thank you for your understanding. And now we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2824. Robin, can you please read a summary of the bill?
Groundhog's Day. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2824 prohibits landlords from requiring tenants to declaw or devocalize animals allowed on premises, prohibits landlords from advertising available units so as to encourage declawing or devocalization, sets a civil penalty of $1,000 per violation. There is no revenue impact, may have a fiscal impact, statement not yet issued. There is no subsequent referral.
And our first witness, Representative Barton.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. I'm Brent Barton. I represent House District 40, and I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 2824, also known as Boomer's Law. This bill would prohibit a landlord conditioning tenancy on getting a dog or cat declawed or debarked. This bill is modeled on a bill that I believe passed unanimously from the California legislature. And I'll circle back to that because it actually causes some potential problems that we might have to fix. So declawing is a procedure that some people are familiar with. It literally, it's a procedure that was, my understanding, is common in the 80s more so and has fallen largely out of practice. It's considered increasingly inhumane. Similarly, it's done primarily on cats. Similarly, debarking is a surgical procedure in which the vocal cord is cut and leads to a series of behavioral problems in dogs. And while these procedures are falling increasingly out of favor, it is not a common practice. And this bill will not in any way affect a landlord's ability to condition tenancy on pets, saying no pets or cats allowed but no dogs. That will not change under this law, but it will prohibit them conditioning tenancy on getting this surgery done. Now, two issues as I see with this bill. First of all, we essentially copied the California bill, and that seemed like a good idea at the time, but it's been brought to our attention, I think quite reasonably, that California landlord-tenant law is simply structured differently than Oregon landlord-tenant law. And for example, on if you look at page 2 at the top, it talks about attorney general, city attorney, district attorney enforcing this section. That is, my understanding is that is common practice in California, but that's not really how we do it in Oregon. So that's something I'm looking forward to chiding with perhaps some subsequent people who will testify on this bill and seeing if we can put this in that will work better in Oregon. The second thing about this bill is I think inherent to any kind of regulation in landlord-tenant law, and that is there's clarity is important, and there's always a possible parade of horribles. What if the animal was already declawed, debarked? What if there are a lot of what ifs, and I'm happy to try to work to clarify this to the maximum extent possible. Ultimately, I think we can get to a bill that can hopefully pass the Oregon legislature unanimously like it did in California. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Any questions?
I have a question. Chair Kenninger, sorry. I have a question. I think there's a bill coming up this session that has to do with service animals. How would that tie in your opinion here? I've read it, but I'm not seeing anything about service animals, and maybe there's already something on the books that I'm not aware of. But how does it apply to service animals? And if service animals are further defined in this session, how will it apply here?
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Hayden, thank you for the question. I'm going to do my best to answer it off the top of my head. I do not believe this bill will affect current law with service animals in any way. My understanding of the current law, and this is where my understanding is worth what you pay for it, which is not much, that right now, for example, I'm a landlord. I once had a tenant who had a service animal. That changes it. That means that service animal is allowed in there, and whether I prohibit dogs and cats in my rental unit or not, service animals are exempt from that prohibition. Service animals trump the landlord's tenant rights. I don't believe this will affect that in any way. Because I think it would currently already perhaps be illegal, at least I hope it would be, to condition. A landlord doesn't have control of whether a service animal would come into a rental unit or not already. So I don't think a landlord would then have the ability to condition that on, say, a decline or debarking procedure. Did that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think it might lead into kind of a definition of what a service animal is. Mm.
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Hayden, a service animal should be defined in statute. I'll have to get the cite for you, but this is a pretty well-established body of law. There is also some case law on point, I know, because this issue comes up from time to time. Again, as we try and craft this bill and make this what I think most people would agree is a good idea, but make it an actually better bill, I'm happy to work with that so that we don't in any way affect that.
Any questions down here? I have a question, Representative Barton. I've also heard it suggested when people saw this bill, why not just outlaw it in the state of Oregon? Do you have any opinion on that? Do you know of any other states that have done that?
Chair Kenny Geyer, thank you for the question. And I have to admit that it's perhaps a failure of imagination on my part, because I think that would be a better approach. rather than, I think we should perhaps get together with the Veterinary Association and craft a bill that works for them so that there's, you know, I don't want to trample on their medical practice, but, and I certainly don't want to, you know, start legislating veterinary medicine, but really ban this practice altogether. I would certainly be open to that. I suspect perhaps the landlords would prefer that. It would make their lives easier. And I'm actually, right now, we're considering opportunities to do that. Maybe we can't get there this session. Perhaps, my understanding, and perhaps other people could correct me, is that one or two or maybe even three states have done that. I believe Maryland, Massachusetts may have done that. But again, that is really me winging it. I'm not 100% sure on that.
Okay. Great. Any other questions?
Thank you, Chair Kennedy.
And I know you have to get back to your Judiciary Committee, so thank you for
thank you very much. Coming in.
We will keep going on testimony for 2824, keep the flow. And so I would like to call up Scott Beckstead, Gwen Baldwin, and Sean Miller. And it looks like Gwen Baldwin, Sean Miller, and Sybil Hebb want to come together. Is that right? Is that right?
George could testify with me as well.
All right, then let's have George Okolich come with Scott, and then we'll have the next panel.
Even though he doesn't like to be seen.
Best to avoid it. Sit over here.
There you go.
Thank you, Chair Kenny-Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, Scott Beckstead, Oregon Senior State Director for the Humane Society of the United States, also serve as the Western Regional Director for the Humane Society of the United States. I don't get to testify before this committee very often, so let me just very briefly tell a little bit about myself. I live in Sutherland, down in North Douglas County. I'm a constituent of Representative Hayden. I've invited him to our beautiful Duchess Horse Sanctuary because he's a horse guy like me, and I hope he'll take me up on that. I have been working for the Humane Society of the United States for almost 7 years now, and I'm here today in strong support of House Bill 2824. The Humane Society of the United States is a national advocacy organization headquartered in Washington, D.C., and we are an advocacy organization. We work to push social institutions like the law to give animals greater protection. One of our emerging ideas and values as an organization is the idea that people and their pets should stay together as much as possible, and that we should, as a society, encourage responsible pet ownership and do everything we can to keep animals in good homes and to favor policies that allow people to keep their animals, because most people who have pets, usually they consider their pets to be part of the family. So that's sort of the driving philosophy behind this bill. What we're trying to do is address the situation where tenants, renters, are faced with the dilemma of either forcing their animals to undergo these terrible procedures or not have a place to live, alternatively of surrendering their animal to the local shelter because they either don't want to put their animal through the procedures or because they can't afford the procedures. So that's the basic concept behind the bill. And the two procedures in question, the decline of cats basically is an amputation of the last digit on a cat's paw, usually on the front feet, and the devocalization of dogs involves the severing or burning of the vocal cords so that the dogs can no longer bark. There are ways to address the behaviors that these animals engage in. When dogs are barking excessively, there's usually a behavioral issue that can be addressed with training, and there are ways to discourage cats from using their claws in a destructive way. The problem is that when these procedures are performed very often, they result in even worsened behavioral problems for the animals. So it is an animal welfare issue. These animals do suffer, and of course the people also suffer when they're forced into a position where they have to make these terrible choices. So As Representative Barton said, we understand that there may be issues with the bill related to the Landlord-Tenant Act. I can certainly extend on behalf of the Humane Society of the United States the willingness to work with the landlords and or the veterinarians to make the bill more palatable to them. But we think that the idea behind the bill is a very, very good one, and we would like to see Oregon take a strong leadership position on this. With respect to your question, Chair Kenny Geyer, about other states that have done all-out bans, Massachusetts and Maryland have both banned the devocalization of dogs. It is an increasingly rare procedure. It's I think disfavored, and I hope that the OVMA will tell you more about that. But the decline of cats is also increasingly disfavored because it is a permanent and painful procedure. And I guess the permanence of these procedures is one of the most compelling arguments, because very often renting a place to live is a temporary situation, but these procedures are permanent and completely irreversible. Once a dog is devocalized or a cat is declawed, there's no turning back, and it's permanent and irreversible. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and I would urge you to vote yes on this bill. Thank you.
Questions before we move on? I have a question. You yes. mentioned that Maryland and Massachusetts banned the devocalization.
Yes.
But what about the decline?
No.
No. Okay, so just those. And then do you know more about the California law?
The California law was basically the template that was used for this law. It received broad bipartisan support and had the support of the rental industry. So the language that you see before you was modeled closely after the California law.
And is that the only state that has passed such a law?
Correct.
Okay, and how long ago was that?
Last year.
Okay, do you know anything about the results of it?
I don't. I could certainly ask my colleagues in California and okay. get some more information to you. I'd be happy to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah, quick question on that, Chair Kenny Geyer. On that subject, I would be interested in our low-income housing, because I don't know, like Section 8 housing,
sure.
what the norm, do they normally allow pets, do they normally not allow pets, and how might that interact with our low-income clients? Would it cause a deterrent for them to get into housing? That would be a concern.
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Hayden, I don't know the exact answer to your question, but I will find out and get back to you.
Okay, thank you.
And that also will be an appropriate question for the next panel that represents renters. I forgot. Sorry.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. I actually wanted to make, just for the record, a clarification from Mr. Beckstead's testimony on decline. He described it as a claw being removed, but for the purposes of this bill, that is one of the definitions of decline. The definition in this bill goes beyond the actual removing of the claw and also includes tendinectomies. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but where you actually sever the tendon so the claws cannot come out. And so it's not always the removing of a claw. It goes beyond that. And anything that would keep the claws from coming out or any sort of procedure based on this definition would kind of encompass that.
Mm-hmm. Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Stark, thank you for that clarification. That's correct.
Okay. Representative Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George O'Coolidge, here on behalf of the Oregon Humane Society. Established in 1868, the Oregon Humane Society is the state's largest and oldest animal welfare organization with over 50,000 supporters statewide. And for the record, we are not affiliated with any local or national organization, and we're here to support House Bill 2824. I won't repeat a lot of the arguments that I've made before. They're sort of a part of my testimony. So I'll just say, you know, barking is a normal behavior for dogs, and they bark to communicate. Scratching is normal behavior for cats. They scratch to mark their territory, to stretch, and to maintain the health of their claws. Scott and Representative Barton talked about some of the surgery that's involved and how significant how it causes significant pain and risk to the animals. But I will put on the record that the American Veterinary Medical Association states that debarking surgery should only be performed by qualified licensed veterinarians, but only as a final alternative to euthanasia after behavioral modifications have failed, and that decline of domestic cats should only be considered to prevent the cat from using its claws destructively or when its claws presents an above normal health risk for its owners. Like I said before, you know, these surgeries are painful, unnecessary, and should not be performed for convenience. A pet should not lose a part of his or her anatomy in exchange for a roof over their heads. And so we'd ask, you know, we look forward to working with, you know, interested parties to get the bill right, but we think it moves in the right direction. We ask for your support.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I'd like to call up Gwen Baldwin, Sean Miller, and Sybil Hebb.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, Gwen Baldwin, representing Multifamily Northwest, members of the committee. I think first and foremost, it's important to separate the underlying issue from the particular application of the issue. And I both personally and professionally want to acknowledge the importance of humane treatment of animals, and that that issue respectfully may not be best addressed in this particular bill, but in, as you said, perhaps a more broad fashion. We've been in front of this committee before, all of us, actually, in one respect or another, through the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, which for 25 years has come together in advance of the session to work through issues related to good public housing, not public, good public policy related to housing, to address issues of clarity for all stakeholders, and to ensure that when we're grappling with issues that we tease through the unintended consequences before we come to you and duke it out here. So the value of coalition, and we do have a coalition bill that's in the hopper again this year, is to address that in advance. So we do spend 6 months or so doing that. And unfortunately, this bill didn't have the benefit of that conversation, of that vetting. And so there are concerns, certainly, that our organization has related to particularly the penalties and the triggers for those penalties that have some potentially unintended consequences, don't fit within the context of the landlord-tenant law as it is written. And it's a very complex law, and we appreciate all the issues that you deal with are in many respects complex, but that also just reinforces the value of coming to this in advance of session, looking at how that impact exists and how to create more clarity than more confusion.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Rental Housing Association. And, you know, we do have concerns with House Bill 2824 as well as drafted. And, you know, I won't repeat what Gwen said, but I do want to just say that, you know, current law, you know, landlords do have the ability to deny or restrict, you know, pets in their dwelling units. And so, you know, when this bill came along, we talked to our landlords. You know, we don't normally and have not heard, and I know there's probably examples out there of advertisements, but you know, most of the time it's, you know, they either allow pets or they don't, or restrict, you know, which pets are in their units. And so, you know, when you look at this bill, when I just listened to the testimony before me, it seems like they're talking about more the practice, which is, you know, again, declawing and devocalizing of this issue. And if that's the issue that they're trying to tackle, the practice of that, you know, again, putting it in the context of just a landlord-tenant law, I don't think is going to at all address the practice of this. And so, you know, I heard the concerns of the proponents. You know, again, the landlord-tenant group, we discuss pets every interim. It's always an issue. It's an issue that we've resolved in our landlord-tenant issue. It's, you know, unrelated to this, but, you know, it's always an issue that we tackle as landlords and tenants. And so, you know, again, you know, we're happy to take this into that group and have that discussion, because I think it's again for 25 years it's been valuable, because we fight among ourselves and then come back with a product and don't have to fight in front of you all. And so, you know, again, I think this bill hasn't had the benefit of that. And again, I'd only encourage you, if we're talking about the practice of this issue, let's deal with that, and maybe you can actually, you know, I think accomplish something versus what I think this particular bill, not sure given, you know, what we do right currently with the normal practice in allowing pets or not allowing pets in the unit. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Kinnegayer, members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb. I'm with the Oregon Law Center, which is a provider of legal assistance to low-income people. And I really appreciate your giving me the time to say just a few words here today. I speak today as a member of the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, who represents tenant interests in that coalition, and just want to give voice to the fact that we really appreciate the work of that group in sort of assessing how any issue impacts the structure of the statute and the chapter as a whole, and it's important, I think, to all of us that those provisions work well for landlords, as well as providing justifiable fairness and protections for tenants. And so that's the balance that we try to strike. I just again will echo that I really appreciate the work of that group and the vetting and making sure that statutory changes really fit within the whole structure. I also really appreciate the work of the Humane Society and certainly support the protections for animals that they are hoping to achieve. So I don't mean this to be critical of that goal, but rather just wanting to be concerned about the practical implications. So thank you.
Question. Chair Kinnegayer, thank you. Do you feel that there might be an opportunity to bring three, and I'm starting to become known on the healthcare as putting it back on the boards that regulate these and giving them an opportunity to bring the veterinarian board together with the housing board and the Humane Society? I think everybody is meaning very, very well here, you know, and I think there's very, very good intention here, but kind of take a step. Get those three entities together, whether we're talking about something global in the state of Oregon as a band versus putting on something that my concern is that there might be a barrier to low-income housing, which is already very, very short in Oregon, that we need to work to increase. And so I don't know. It almost sounds like there might be value in stepping back, talking about it, and then coming back to us.
Thank you, Chair. I had somebody approach me today about this bill, and surprisingly only one person. And their concern was they felt like there was a loophole for the therapeutic pets. You know, that a housing, you know, a landlord could say, well, I don't want pets, and therefore that could rid the availability or the worry about damage from pets. They could just deny to have pets. And they said, well, the problem is if there is a therapeutic pet or a service animal, that those would be the ones that then would have access to that facility and therefore could damage it. Can you address what are the protections for the landlords when it comes to therapeutic or service animals? What are the protections for the landlords if the property is damaged when they wouldn't normally allow animals?
So, Chair Kinnegayer, Representative Stark, I'll try my best to answer your question, and I really appreciate the concerns coming from many members about the impact on low-income individuals as well as on individuals who may have service animals or companion animals. So there's a broad structure of both the Federal Fair Housing Act, as I'm sure you know, as well as the State Fair Housing Act, has provisions that landlords are bound by in terms of addressing people who have disabilities and have service or companion animal needs. And so the landlords would have to make reasonable accommodations for those individuals, and that would mean probably in most circumstances making an exception to a no pet rule. That doesn't mean they can't put reasonable restrictions on how the pet behaves or what the standards are around how that pet interacts. Sometimes there are also reasonable accommodations that may come up with respect to those rules as well. It's a fairly case-by-case analysis is my best answer. But for more specific information, I probably would need to go grab my statutes and look at it more closely.
Madam Chair.
And, go ahead.
I'm sorry, if I could just follow up on that. I think you're right. We would have to make reasonable accommodations, but I think if there is damage, they're still responsible for that damage. And so I think I think if you're asking if there's specific damage, even though we are required by law, they are responsible for that, and they would either under our lease agreement have to at least address those damages.
Okay, so follow up. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So in current law, can a landlord, and those a landlord who has made one of those reasonable provisions to have a therapeutic cat, can that landlord require the owner to declaw that cat in current law?
I don't know the answer to that question, Representative Chair Kinnegar.
Representative Starr, that's a very good question. I think it would be a matter of whether that falls under those reasonable accommodations. So we'll have to look into that. That's a real good question.
In federal fair housing, how they would view that and what particular pieces are in play, that would be much more of the driver than Oregon landlord-tenant law.
Thank you.
Good question. And I'm almost tempted to say yes, because that's why we have this issue, is that landlords have the ability to say, we'll take renters as long as they're declawed. So I'm not sure why it would be different for a service animal, but maybe. But the thing I was going to say is I wonder if anyone has statistics on how many service animals need to be declawed or debarked, because they go through a very extensive training. Yeah. And, they're not released to somebody as a service animal until they're like better behaved than any other kind of pets out there. So I'm guessing that's not a huge issue, but I again applaud this committee for coming up with concerns about vulnerable populations.
I'd like to actually to respond. I know that's better for a work session, to respond directly to your question. But therapeutic pets aren't always the same as service animals. So a companion cat for someone who is suffering from depression would not have gone through the same training that, a CNI dog would.
Good point. I was going to just make another comment that some of the legislation we passed last year for Section 8 sets up a fund, I think it was $5,000, to cover damages if somebody left and they left damages in a rental and weren't able to cover that themselves. That was part of our expansion and improvement on the Section 8 housing, so that would help there. I'm curious what you think about having an outright ban. I don't know how that would pertain to service animals or companion animals, but an outright ban on declawing and debarking.
Was
that preferable to you?
We would be neutral to a bill like that. Uh-huh. I mean, I think our issue is just trying to, what does this accomplish in landlord-tenant law? And there's issues around how this fits in. I think if you go that direction to address some of the issues I heard, we would be neutral on that. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, it feels like if there's a ban on that practice within the veterinary community, that there's not really an impact on housing that I can think of, although we haven't really delved into this issue and all of its...
Although potentially there is for low income. I would think renters and landlords would feel better about it because they're not being singled out. Like, why should we allow this practice with a homeowner, right? Exactly. If it's a barbaric practice. I do wonder about the impact on low-income populations, because then the only thing that landlords can do if they're worried about barking is evict or not. So they're, and I'm curious if you have any statistics on right now how many landlords require debarking or just outright ban pets. Is there, is it a small minority? Is it the majority?
We believe it's small, because the landlords I've talked to, that's not an issue. It's literally, are they going to allow pets? Are they not going to allow pets? Yeah. You mentioned, barking. If for instance, a tenant has an animal that is disturbing, tenants or just, the landlord can you know, try to address that issue. I mean, again, they're not requiring them to, debark, and it's just they could actually, but if it is disturbing others in the tenancy, they have remedies to actually do that under current landlord tenant law. So, but again, that's not a normal practice to say you have to de-vocalize in that instance. I haven't heard that.
Okay, great. Any other questions? I am hoping that you and the Humane Society can get together with Representatives Barton and Gomberg. And I think Barton is very open to the idea of an outright ban, and so that may, you may still want to be involved more from the tenant perspective than from the landlord perspective, because I think that pretty much eliminates you as an interested party, probably.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
It may not eliminate.
Yeah, we only pointed out that if they go that direction, it's obviously it does not fit in the relating clause, so that would require
exactly. It requires a new bill, and that's why I thought we need to do this quickly before February 25th.
Yep. Yes. Thank you.
So, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Great. So I'm going to close the public hearing on that was House Bill 2824, and we'll open an informational meeting on the Oregon Youth Authority. And I call Ferry Boers, Pakshresht. Am I saying it right?
Do you want to introduce? That's pretty close.
That's close. I was able to greet you in Persian, but not quite. Say your name.
I think you've gotten as close as anybody has. Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ferry Boers Pakshresht. I'm the Director of Oregon Youth Authority, and we've been asked to do a very quick presentation, agency overview, and for that reason we have, this will be a very high-level overview. I'm not going to go into details, and there are some slides following the presentation that's there. I'd be glad to go over those, but I'm relying on you to guide me around time.
Okay.
So we'll start with the mission of the Oregon Youth Authority, which has not changed since the beginning of the establishment of the agency with the creation of passage of Senate Bill 1 during the 1995 session. And our mission is to protect the public and reduce crimes by holding youth offenders accountable and providing opportunities for reformation in safe environments. Our vision is that youth who leave OYA lead not only crime-free lives, but also productive lives. And our values have been created by actually our staff from various parts of the agency, and you can see they're listed there: integrity, professionalism, accountability, and respect. We are a public safety agency, but we, at the same time, we're committed to education and treatment. And that's really what separates us from quote-unquote adult corrections, primarily because of the resources that we have been granted and our funding structure. We have nearly 1,000 employees, 10 close custody facilities, which include also transition camps, 25 field offices, and you can see our general fund and total fund budget on that slide. And we serve, and this slide actually is a snapshot from 2014, but the numbers are pretty close. Around 1,500 youth. This slide shows the location of
Can
our
I
close
just say one thing
sure.
there? I just pointed out that that's one staff to every 1.5 youth.
Yes. You're absolutely correct, yes. Overall, and yes. You can see the location of our close custody facilities. In red stars, you can see that actually we have two facilities in the valley, one in Albany, our only female facility. We have a transition camp in Florence. We have a transition camp in Le Grand, and one in Tillamook. And we do also run a transition program from the Oak Creek female facility in Albany. And then the rest of the red stars are youth correctional facilities or closed custody facilities. And then the blue stars are our parole and probation offices across the state. This is the map of the location of our residential providers. We have 32, roughly 32 residential providers across Oregon. You can see how they're distributed across the state, roughly aligned with the population centers. We have a total of 115 foster care and proctor care homes. And again, they're located across Oregon. They provide valuable services. It's very difficult to find foster homes for at-risk youth. This slide shows that from nearly 390,000 youth in Oregon, and again, this number is from 2013, a very small subset enter into the custody of the counties that manage at-risk youth, and a much smaller subset into Oregon Youth Authority. And again, these numbers are from a couple of years ago. This slide shows that breakdown of the 1,524 youth. You can see that 885 are under community supervision and 639 are in close custody facilities. Interesting point there also is that the close custody youth are divided almost equally between those youth who are committed to us through the adult court and those who are committed to us through the juvenile court. This slide shows the types of crimes committed by youth who come to us. And again, you can see the breakdown. The majority is primarily youth who offend sexual offenses and then property crimes. And then you can see the rest of the category of crimes. This is a pretty informative and at the same time sobering slide because what it shows is the social characteristics of the youth who come to us. The high rate of usage of alcohol and drug, at the same time, those youth who have been diagnosed with mental health, we can see very high percentage. Conduct disorder, past suicidal behavior. When you look at the sexually abused column, 45% of our females and 14% of our males, and these are reported sexual abuses, have been sexually abused in most cases by family members. And, you know, what this shows, and again, when you go down, you can see the parent use of alcohol and drugs. 9% of our girls and 12% of our boys are already the biological parent of a child. So in many cases, these youth are victims, have been victims. In the process, they created their own victims. So one of our main tasks and responsibility is not to further traumatize them in this process. So what are the opportunities? The opportunities, one of the greatest opportunity that we have, one of the greatest asset that we have is this automated information system called Juvenile Justice Information System that's owned collectively by Oregon Youth Authority and the 36 counties. It's a one-of-a-kind system in the country. I think that is still true, which connects all of us together and provides information on youth, whether served by the counties or Oregon Youth Authority. We have a great opportunity to incorporate newly developed tools and practices, data and research informed into our approach and practice. And I'll talk in a moment about the youth reformation system. We have always had the opportunity, and I think we're taking great advantage of that, to work collaboratively with our partners, both providers and counties, and we have some of our county partners in the room today. And the last bullet there is avoiding the pendulum effect. And what do I mean by that? Briefly, you know, the practice in juvenile justice has shifted based on philosophy and perspectives. It started with a developmental or therapeutic approach. In the early 90s, it went to a correctional approach because of the rise in youth crimes. And, you know, in the past 10 years, it's been swinging the other way. You know, some social service foundations have been calling for the closure of all close custody facilities, et cetera. Our approach in Oregon, and again, in conjunction with our county partners, has been to approach this question in a different way. It is by through asking a series of questions. What should be the capacity of our system today and in the future? Are we bringing the right youth in the system, and are we placing them in the right environment? What should be the length of stay? How long should the kids stay with us? What kind of programming and intervention is needed for the youth to succeed? How do we hire and support the kind of staff that actually can help the reformation and treatment of these youth? How do we create environments where these youth are viewed as assets rather than liabilities? I'll talk about that in just a moment. How do we support the integration of youth in their communities? That's one of the major points of failure, the reintegration, because, you know, they might do really well while they're with us, and there may be circumstances that leads to their failure when they return. And I think all of you would want to know that. if you're investing in something, is it paying back? And how do we measure that? So with that, we developed what we call, you know, this approach that we have, which we call the Youth Reformation System. It has various components and subsets. What is the Youth Reformation System? It's a system that uses data, research, and predictive analytics to inform decision-making, and that's an important point, not to make decisions, but to inform decisions. We never want to turn youth into numbers, support professional discretion, and reduce victimization and maximize the use of resources. It includes four components, and my apologies, I'm flying through this just because of time. You know, it has four components, population forecast, and these components actually answer those questions that I asked in previous slides. Placement and treatment, are the youth being placed in the right environment, and are we providing the right treatment for them? Program evaluation, which basically informs us as to the effectiveness of the programs and services that we provide. Finally, the community context. There is this study that we're doing right now that's called the Feeder System Study. Briefly, what is feeding the system? You know, how many contacts youth have had with previous social service systems, and can we begin to identify early point of intervention and providing resources for youth way earlier in the continuum? And then from the point of transition, can we work with the communities to return youth in a way that they're going to be successful? And I think the following testimony that you will be hearing on a bill might address those two efforts, both, you know, preventing the youth from coming into our system and helping them be successful when they exit the system. But in order to implement the system, you need a culture. You need a shift in mindset. We are transitioning from a strictly correctional approach to a developmental approach. And that's what we call positive human development. It is based on supportive relationships and meaningful participation, providing opportunities for youth. It absolutely is based on accountability, and I'll show you a slide in a moment. It increases engagement and facilitates learning. It's actually based on the foundation of safety and security. We have to keep staff safe. We have to provide a secure environment for them, but it is also based on caring and supportive relationships. The main difference between youth and adults is that, as all of you know, the brain is still developing up to age 25. I can stop.
Yes, go ahead. Would you like
Thank you,
question?
Chair. I was trying to indicate that at some point I have a question, but didn't mean to interrupt you. I apologize. So back one slide, you talked about kind of the goals and so forth. What are the current recidivism rates back into the youth juvenile system, and also into for the adult population once that they would, you know, recidivism rates there?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Stark. That's a great question, and recidivism is defined in different ways. But, you know, in the way that we define it, and it's aligned with the Oregon Department of Corrections definition, our recidivism rate is right around 28%, the total recidivism rate. Now, the you know, there's a breakdown in the juvenile population recidivism rate, in the adult population recidivism rate, and then the subset that we actually transfer to the Department of Corrections because of behavior. So there are various breakdown in those. I'd be glad to provide those for you. I can tell you that data and research and our own numbers show that when youth are transferred to the Department of Corrections because of behavior, the recidivism rate is much higher. In other words, about 44% versus if they actually finish their time with the Oregon Youth Authority. So, and again, I can provide breakdown if you would like. So, you know, in the middle of this triangle is high expectations and accountability, meaningful participation, and community connection. And again, you know, as I was saying, the main point of emphasis here is the developmental process of the youth, and so that we don't compromise that development and actually to return healthy, productive youth back to the community. What are our practices and tools? Again, there are a series of practices and tools, and there's a slide that's at the tail end of this presentation. But it is really focused on supporting pro-social, building pro-social skills for kids, which actually is data and research shows that it is education and developing youth with social skills are key to reducing recidivism and creating better outcomes. And again, all of that is the foundation is accountability.
Excuse me. Could you say a little bit more about what that is? What kind of skills, social skills? And how do you do that?
Absolutely. It is simply interaction skills. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the youth who come to us, mm-hmm. Many of them are deficient in some very basic social skills. Mm-hmm. How do you appropriately communicate with others? Mm-hmm. What is the appropriate way to dealing with the opposite gender or someone who might be different from you, mm-hmm. from your social or ethnic background? And with that, I should also say that we have a problem in the system, both in the youth and the adult system, in overrepresentation of minority youth, mm-hmm. particularly the African American and Native American, lesser extent Latino youth, and we have an underrepresentation of Caucasian and Asian youth, mm-hmm. in the system. And I think you all know about that, but I just wanted to emphasize that. How do we actually show that we are accountable, and how do we measure our results? The first state agency in Oregon that implemented what we call this the fundamentals map. This basically describes our core processes, key processes, process measures. Representative Peluso knows about that because she was on our funding team last session. A series of hundreds of measures that we report on a quarterly basis and measure our progress. So really that was the core of the presentation. Our challenges naturally is implementing the system, because it's easy to come up with systems and intellectual processes, but to implement those on the ground level requires connecting research to practice. And that's really what we're trying to do in the Oregon Youth Authority. It is about changing our culture and changing our mindsets. And it is most importantly about balancing security with a developmental safety and security with a developmental approach. And aligning our physical infrastructure, some of our buildings, especially in the valley, were built in the 1920s. They're not safe seismically. They're not structured correctly with the latest knowledge that we have and the research that we know about reforming youth. And that's part of our ask this session to get some funding in terms of bonds to rebuild those facilities. In fact, our facilities plan calls for the closure of one of our facilities in the valley and consolidating that into McLaren campus in Woodburn. And naturally modernizing JGIS. All of this work is done because we have this data system, and we need to modernize that in order to be able to continue this work. And again, that's the end of my presentation. There are a series of other slides in here that, is provided for your reference.
Sir, we have a technical problem, and the video went out again.
Now. The feeder system.
We have
to have those on right now because you're talking.
But is it recording? No, still not recording.
Mm-hmm. So are we still at ease, but we're being recorded?
We're at ease and having an informal conversation. Is that fine?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yeah, we're at ease having an informal conversation, but it still needs to be recorded, so, which is why it's going to be on the audio recording, but not on the video recording.
Is it audio recorded now?
It's audio recorded
now.
So
we can proceed?
They would prefer if we would wait, but I can call and ask if we can proceed. Give me a moment.
Can we continue to have informal conversation?
We're recording our informal conversation.
Okay. Yeah.
And you were saying.
Yes, Representative Stark, we are, the feeder system study that we're doing right now is identifying the number of previously OYA youth who enter into the adult system, not necessarily incarcerated. Mm-hmm. They're about 9% of the population that go into the broader.
I'm just going to take us out of ease. We're back on. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Ken Geyer, Representative Stark. So, these numbers, are just out. I'm thinking about 2% that actually go into the DOC close custody prison system, and around 9% that goes into broader probation, adult probation, etc. But we should have that study out within a few weeks. And, you know, this slide here
just... Do you want to go back a couple slides that when we were not being recorded?
Do you want me to
explain
this?
That's where you were, right.
Sure.
That would be
so
great.
This slide shows the comparison of the Oregon youth population between the ages of 12 and 25 with the Oregon OYA population. And you can see that very few 12 and 13-year-olds, relatively few 14 and 15. The majority of the population is between the ages of 16 and 20, and then, again, a smaller 21 to 24 years of age. And this is the breakdown of the male and female population, almost evenly divided in Oregon in that same age range, and predominantly male in the OYA system. And then this slide here actually shows the overrepresentation of minorities in Oregon. You can see, again, a major overrepresentation of African American, Native American, and Latino youth, and underrepresentation of Asian and Caucasian youth. And, you know, the point here is also when you look at the African American numbers there, 3% Oregon, 9% OYA, if you actually further break down that number between the close custody facilities and the probation population, it gets worse. It's about 12%, 11 or 12% for African Americans.
In the close custody. Yeah. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. On your kids, and particularly children who are minorities, are you tracking at all sort of where they stopped in the education timeline? Like, if you're getting a 16-year-old kid who shows up, I mean, do we have a sense of eighth grade, the last grade they completed with any measure of success? Are you tracking ed records to these kids? And like I said, particularly since we have sort of and I've served on Ed for 4 years, where we have a correlation between minority children and disparities in educational outcomes in those communities, and then you see this disproportionate percentage of minority children showing up in our, you know, correction system. It's a problem nationally, and other states where they have larger minority communities are certainly working on ways to close some of those gaps, and they see correlation. But I'm curious if we are tracking that correlation of head outcomes in these populations to entrance into corrections.
Yeah, Chair Kenegaya, I represent the parish. I don't have those numbers with me. What I can tell you, we can get those numbers. What I can tell you is that the majority of youth come into our system with almost, with few or no credits. And they are way behind as far as the K through 12 education goes. If you actually look at this whole phenomenon of school-to-prison pipeline, many of these youth were skipping class, were, you know, expelled from school. And I'm sure you know, having the education background, that education is one of the most important aspects of success in this system. There was a study done in Texas in many years ago and updated in 2011. Where it showed, and this is the adult system, where the general rate of recidivism was 60%. Those who graduated with high school degrees recidivated at 24%, with a two-year degree at 17%, with a bachelor's degree at 5%, and with a master's degree at 0%. So, I mean, that's the impact of education. And again, I haven't really spent any time talking about education, but our kids go to school every day. They don't have a choice. And we have, just in 2014, we had 356 high school diplomas in OYA, and, you know, 149 GEDs and 6 college degrees. So that's, we can, you know, get you the specific minority population educational record. My sense is very dismal. And, yeah.
I have a couple follow-ups, if you don't mind. So are those kiddos, I mean, are you using, having to use correction dollars for those kids, or are you getting state school fund dollars?
We actually get state school fund dollars, and our education system is contracted through the Department of Education with educational service districts across Oregon.
Okay, then so follow-up would be, are those kids then weighted for what we would normally wait children for, so kids on IEPs, kids with disabilities and poverty and everything else, ELL? all of those things?
It's, you know, the measurement is the same as the school, the general. I mean, the Department of Education measures all of those measurements with all the population, including the ones in closed custody facilities.
I'll ask real quick follow-up on that. So we hear a lot about, and you mentioned the number of diplomas, which thank you for making that happen. So how are you tracking for sort of graduation rates in general in this population, not just on a raw numbers, but sort of more as a percentage? Where does the education that's being delivered to these kids, where does that, is that comparable to, like, a, you know, maybe Portland Public Schools, or is it better than, I mean, where do you think you fall in that mix?
Chair Ken Guy, Representative Parrish, you're talking about the quality of education. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I would like to say and hope to say that it is on par. You know, the focus and the effort that's put into educating these kids, I think, is second to none. You know, our teachers are totally committed, although I can tell you that the quality can improve. We can improve the quality, and we're working on that with the Department of Education. You know, to I don't have any numbers that compares our quality with Portland Public Schools, but
or any district.
Yeah, sure. But they get the same you know, classes, the same level of education, and at the same time, I can tell you that there can be improvements in that.
I'm not on education. Switching gears, there's a lot of data that shows that you know, children who've got substance abuse problems tend to also fall into this population. What are you seeing in terms of kids who are coming into the system, particularly in the minority communities, with substance abuse issues and challenges? And I know I've seen sort of anecdotally firsthand issues around trying to get that solved. Maybe I missed the screen.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Right.
But,
bad news.
Very high. Teach me to go out into the outside and wash my hands after sneezing. But all right.
Although, thank you for that.
Yeah.
It doesn't address the minority part, but
yeah. And specifically, I am interested in the minority part, because as a general, what we're seeing with some of these youth on a per, you know, sort of on a per capita basis, where you're seeing kids with from the minority communities are really struggling with substance abuse issues compared to, you know, their Caucasian peers. I'm curious if we're seeing that show up in the prison population with these kids as well, the corrections population.
Yes. Chair Ken Guy, Representative Parrish, our feeder system study is actually focusing on specifically those questions. And what we're seeing is specifically with the minority population, they track with around, you know, the same percentages, but their use of those services prior to coming to OYA has not been on par with the Caucasian population. So whether that is, you know, because of the lack of accessing services, not having knowledge about the services existing, et cetera, again, you know, there's some very interesting data emerging, and that study shows that the highest prevalence for coming into OYA is because of alcohol and drug, and, you know, also mental health issues, which is confirmed in this slide as well.
Representative Taylor?
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. Well, thank you so much for this work. This is tough work, I know, I imagine. Regarding, you said earlier about, you know, trying to identify what's feeding this problem, and I appreciate your attention on that. And so you gather all of this information, which is very informative, and I don't think anyone's too surprised. I'm surprised that high percentage of numbers are disturbing, but that these are the things that cause kids to end up in, shall we say, trouble. So when you... Can you talk a little bit about what you do to work with other entities, public schools or communities, to reduce the number of kids that are ending up in the system? So now it seems like the problems are very well identified. And now about who you're working with to try to reduce the number of kids who end up in the system.
So. Chair Kenigai, Representative Taylor, our study is in the preliminary stages. We just released our second paper on the feeder system study. And in that study, what we did, we actually compared the OYA population around 9,000 with 9,000 other youth who did not enter the OYA system. And we basically wanted the mirror population to see what causes youth to come, or you know, what are a series of causes that bring youth away. And, you know, this is what we found. As far as alcohol and drug treatment services, 43% of our OYA youth have contact with those services, meaning that they had a problem, and only 8% of the youth who did not come to OYA had access to those services.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Chair Kennegar. What I'm trying to understand is that, so now you know this, so then what will happen?
Right. So what we're doing now, we're gathering data at the aggregate level. So this data is not going to enable us to focus on specific families or youth. The third paper that we'll be releasing, and I would think it's within the next 6 months or so, is going to identify, the population that could use the help and the services earlier in order to divert you from OYA. Meanwhile, we are also including education data in the next study. So that will inform us, what is the correlation between specific youth having problems in education system and then those ending up in OYA. And by combining data and providing that data to child welfare, to education, to mental health and addiction services, our hope is that earlier intervention can take place in order to divert youth from the system. Meanwhile, again, the testimony that you're going to be hearing and the bill that follows is yet another attempt to provide yet another stream of services, earlier intervention. You know, in many times, youth who come to us also have family problems at home. So rather than just dealing with youth, actually intensive supervision with families in order to divert youth from our system.
Thank you. Representative Parrish?
Quick question about this slide, and I appreciate you going back to it. A couple of numbers sort of jump out at me there in terms of just kind of disparity between, boys and girls, particularly the higher sort of diagnosed with mental health on the, almost 20% higher on the mental health for young girls. And then the really sort of dramatic number there about the disparity between sex abuse with girls, between girls and boys. Is it because it is underreported, particularly on the sex abuse side of things, is underreported to you? I mean, and where do you get those numbers? Is it anecdotal from kids? Is it medical records? Is it court cases? Like, how do you actually track and pull those numbers? Because 14% actually seems really low when you look at sort of who your pool of kiddos are in OYA and maybe some of the things that they've experienced. 14 strikes me as very low, and a 20% disparity on the mental health between the two looks out of whack to me as well.
Chair Kennegar, Representative Parrish, actually a very insightful question. We get our numbers both from the records that exist and interviews that are done with youth at intake. So some of it is self-disclosed. I think your hypothesis, I agree with that boys tend to underreport sexual abuse rather than girls. And then I think we can also talk about the correlation between those 45% sexually abused females and the use of alcohol and drug and mental health. Quite often, the use of substance is to cover the pain. And that also, the use itself leads to some mental health symptoms that may not necessarily be a core mental health problem. But, when you begin to take drugs, they can have some significant effect. Now, those are hypotheses. But from the trends that we're seeing, I think those are pretty safe hypotheses to make. When you look at the criminality between girls and boys, they're way different. Girls are far less criminal. Quite often, suicidal behavior, far higher in girls than they are in boys. And then again, you correlate that to the trauma that has been inflicted, and how does that relate to suicidal attempts, etc.
It does seem like the one thing that jumps out at me is perhaps missing here is just child abuse, separate from sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. And I would expect that the boys would have a lot more in that category.
Chair Kennegar, again, our feeder system study shows that 24% of OYA youth have been under child protective services. Again, that's just data that just came out.
And in addition to the high school courses, GED courses, social interaction, social skills, building. What do you do in terms of drug treatment, therapeutic services, all of those kinds of things?
Chair Kenny Geyer, the treatment services are actually in various fronts. One is to address the criminality of youth. So, you know, if you're an arsonist, we have an arson curriculum that you have to go through. If you have offended sexually, there is a sexual treatment curriculum that you go through. Social skill building are a variety of classes that we offer. We have our own curriculum. We have volunteers that come in that teach kids. And, you know, currently we are offering a nonviolent communication course, how do you begin to resolve situations differently. We have a collaborative problem solving course that motivational interviewing, money management, because if you're 16 and you come into our system, and you have an adult sentence and you have let's say 6 or 8 years, you're released at 22, you go back to the community, you've never paid rent, you never really know how to buy a bus ticket or anything like that, and the adult system is not funded to provide that kind of service. We do our best, but there is a gap that exists there.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Did you get through all your slides?
I think I did.
I think you did. Okay, that's great. And thank you very much for your informational hearing. I'm hoping you might want to stay to hear the next bill.
I am very interested to stay.
Good.
Thank you so much.
You may have a comment on that, so thank you. Close the informational meeting and open a public hearing on House Bill 2031. And Robin, please give us a summary of the bill.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2031 establishes pilot project for in-home rehabilitation for juvenile offenders at Oregon Youth Authority, authorizes contracting with nonprofit organizations, directs OYA to evaluate project and report findings to the legislature by 2017, requests appropriations, sunsets June 20th, 2017, declares an emergency effective on passage, no revenue impact, may have a fiscal impact, statement not issued, subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, I call on Representative Hack and Representative Stark to introduce the bill.
And will you call Janet?
It's okay.
I'll do that next
week. Yeah. Carl can come with us. She's
oh, good. Oh, you want to all come together. Okay, great.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, I'm Representative Jody Hack, and I'm here today to talk to you about House Bill 2031. But first, I'd like to give credit where credit is really due. I get the honor of presenting this bill, but to be honest, the real credit needs to go to Commissioner Janet Carlson of Marion County and her team and their dedication to working with our youth, as well as Multnomah County and the folks there and their dedication to working with our youth, and the Oregon Youth Authority and the folks who really have their boots on the ground that continue to do the hard work every day. So while I appreciate the honor in presenting this bill, it really came from these folks. So with that, I'll go straight to the point. Right now, youth in the Oregon juvenile justice system face a very serious risk. They face the risk of continuing down the path they have started early in their lives, a path of unlawful behavior, social and family instability, and most likely conviction for their actions unless we do something to end the cycle of dysfunction and assist them in their rehabilitation. It is our duty as elected officials and as Oregonians to do everything in our power to secure that these at-risk youth are not forgotten or written off as criminals, but instead are put into programs where they are surrounded by people who love them and have their best interests at heart. House Bill 2031 will establish a program that does exactly that. I'm here today on behalf of House Bill 2031, which will create a juvenile justice pilot program that brings intensive in-home services to the at-risk youth of Marion and Multnomah counties and their families. The competent members of the Oregon Youth Authority, whom you have just heard from, will be handling the provider contract and conduct an evaluation on the success of this pilot program and will determine whether or not to replicate it statewide. This bill will specifically target youth offenders who have entered the juvenile justice system early, those struggling with mental illness, and those who have three or more criminal referrals within a 12-month period. These are minor offenses in nature and are not reflective of Measure 11 crimes. These at-risk youth will be placed into a holistic, evidence-based, and intense in-home service that will be specifically tailored to meet the needs of youth individually, as well as equipping the family with the tools they need and involving them in the process every step of the way. The way the system works now, youth are sent across our state to receive treatment and are taken out of the home, diminishing the strength of the family unit. I am passionate about this bill because it will serve to strengthen the family institution, and we all know the importance of keeping families together, especially when dealing with juveniles. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, I implore you to support this bill with the Dash 1 amendment, keeping in mind the deep and positive impact it will have on youth and families involved. Thank you, and also thank you to Vice Chair Rep Stark for agreeing to help me and co-chief sponsor this bill.
Thank you, Representative Pack.
My name is Dwayne Stark, for the record, and so Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, thank you for hearing me testify today. I will in no way be nearly as articulate as Representative Hack here was, but I did.
Representative Stark, can you just tell us your district number? And Representative Hack, if you didn't tell us your district number, maybe just tell us.
So Dwayne
Stark,
House
District 19.
House District, and I'm House District 4. So, and I want to kind of echo Rep Hack in that I had no input into crafting this bill, but I'm very excited about it. I've only known about it for about a week now, and as soon as I found out about it, I wanted to sign on because I really believe in what this does. And so, but before I get into the social part of why I believe in what this bill attempts to study and do, as a member of the Subcommittee for Ways and Means on Human Services, I want to point out one of the financial impacts of this. As you saw in the last presentation from OIA, some of these numbers of what it costs to incarcerate or a youth is very, very expensive. We saw that annually it's about $302 million for 1,524 youth. I calculate that, you know, just rough calculation of over $198,000 a year per youth to have them go to OIA. Now, that's not a measure of the performance of OIA, but just that it's not a cheap endeavor to do. And so I believe that we should, on a regular basis, be looking for more cost-effective solutions. But that's not really what's behind this. Okay, that is a side benefit of this. You also saw, I believe it was on page 10 of that previous presentation, as he talked about the different social behaviors and the mental health behaviors that these youth experience. And you saw that for the males, roughly 70%, and the females, roughly 89% of them experiencing some sort of mental health disorder. And I have some personal experience working in psychiatric rehab facilities for troubled youth. And I've also worked with youth who were incarcerated, and we would get them out, you know, out of juvie for the day and so forth, and take them into community service projects. And one of the ongoing challenges is to find that happy medium between OIA and residential treatment. Mm-hmm. And there are so many, I mean, with the advances in treatment services that are now available, there are so many solutions that we could attempt between those two that are both cost-effective and do a better job of integrating these youth into everyday community and preparing them for adult life. And so I'm excited to see a program that embraces doing that, that wraps them up in services, helps treat them for those mental health disorders and get them all the support services they need, keep them out of that system, integrate them into society, and save a lot of money while doing it. So I'm very supportive of this pilot program. As Rep. Hack discussed, there's still some small fine-tuning, I think, is that it's going on with this bill. But I'm excited about it, and I'm here to pledge my support to it.
Thank you. Commissioner Carlson.
Well, thank you very much, Representative Kenny Geyer, Chair Kenny Geyer, and members of the committee. I am Commissioner Janet Carlson from Marion County, and Commissioner Judy Shiprock could not be here today, but she's been working with me on this bill, and I spoke with her this morning on the phone, and she's very excited that it's up for a hearing as well. I want to thank Representative Hack and Representative Stark, who I'm just meeting at the table here today. Thank you very much. And also, we need to acknowledge Representative Bowles, because this was one of two bills that she introduced and helped us put together. In her short tenure as a legislator, she was appointed to replace Representative Kevin Cameron, who is now Commissioner Cameron and is my colleague in Marion County. So all of these things going together. So House Bill 2031, let me move to that. It really stems from several things. One is the complex needs of youth. And that slide, number 10, that we're all referring to, mental health concerns, substance abuse, family dynamics, cultural barriers, multiple risk factors, as you saw there. So the needs of youth that we're seeing at the county level as well as at the state level are very complex. Secondly, I think it's important to understand the system, the juvenile system. OIA is certainly a critical piece of that system, but the full juvenile system does include county juvenile departments. And in fact, the vast majority of youth that enter the system enter at the county level and are never at the state level. It's kind of the tip of the iceberg. So we need to work in partnership, and some of the prevention work that you were asking about, Representative Taylor, really happens in many times at the local and community level through the county juvenile departments and through the partners that work at that local level. So then the second thing that it stems from as well is a growing body of research. We have tools in the toolbox that we've been using to work with youth at the juvenile level, whether it be at the Oregon Youth Authority and at the counties. We have detention facilities. We have close custody facilities. We have learned, I think, over the years and through the research that if a youth has a mental health concern and all of these multiple problems, simply detaining them at the county level is not going to address those particular needs. Doing community service will be helpful, but it's still not going to address those very intensive and complex needs and underlying issues. We have residential treatment facilities, and in Oregon, the Oregon Youth Authority holds the funding for that, and then youth are committed to OIA to get a residential bed. Multnomah County has a number of residential beds. In Marion County, we have very few. We have one facility in Marion County. It has 10 beds. At one point in time, we had about half of those, five, for all of the youth that we have in Marion County. So, and I think residential treatment was actually restructured about 10 years ago. So instead of youth staying for a year or two, a year and a half, it's a short stay, and then they come back to get stabilized. But even so, if you think about it, if you take a youth with these complex needs, with these family issues, you take them out of Marion County and you send them to Albany or Eastern Oregon or Portland or somewhere else, they stay for 2 months, 3 months, then they come back to exactly the same situation that they were in before, with the same family dynamics, the same peer group. What have you accomplished there? It unravels really the good work that has gone on in that residential treatment. Not to say there's not a need and there are some youth that really benefit, but certainly there's a gap, I think, in the continuum of services when you look at what is needed for these youth. So, again, we need to change the family dynamic. We need to look at the peer groups and do what is effective. And intensive in-home services, we think, is one of the strategies that could fill that gap, and that's the focus of this demonstration project that we would like to have passed before the legislature and be able to work on as a two-county system and then be able to replicate that across the state. We have seen through this model that has been used in other states that strong outcomes have been demonstrated. And I forgot to ask at the outset, we did send ahead a flyer, and you have that, I'm hoping, in your materials. And also we submitted a letter from the Board of Commissioners of Marion County with our support. I wanted to address the Dash 1 amendment. As we were putting the bill together, it was mostly probably my fault that the definition that got in is the way that it is. I was looking for a really broad definition of youth, and the definition
not being an attorney, that we used really only allows us to take youth that are alleged to have committed a crime and not youth that are out under the jurisdiction of the court or of juvenile department. So we needed to broaden that definition to include both what we call pre-adjudicated youth and adjudicated youth. I think our target population is actually going to be those very high-risk, high-needs youth that are adjudicated. But again, if we have that very broad definition, if there are siblings involved in the family and they are have not yet been adjudicated, this will allow us to have the broadest possible look at the youth that we want to serve. So we don't want a narrow definition to limit the systems work that we want to do in this demonstration project. Lastly, what I'd like to say, and I know this is, has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and you are the committee that looks at the substantive issues, and so I won't really deal with the fiscal impact. We have calculated the cost that we think that we will need for this particular project, and it is in the materials that you received. The amount that we're asking for is not all that would be needed for those two counties to address the needs of all of the youth that we've identified. We're calling it a down payment. It is one-time money, kind of to answer some of the questions. So are you going to be back next session? The answer is no. In fact, in Marion County, we are starting to draw down Title IV e-money, which is to avoid out-of-home placement. We just got our first drawdown in January, and we certainly have a ways to go, but we see that if we can take this money that we would get from the legislature and the legislative direction, be able to jumpstart the project, and then over time, as we're drawing down Title IV-E in Marion County, that would supplement it, we could sustain the services over time and build it with other revenue sources that we could identify as well. And then thirdly, I would like to say in the replication process, we have had the discussion in the public safety steering committee at the Association of Oregon Counties about what we're doing. Certainly when you have two counties that are getting something and the other counties are getting nothing for a while with the promise of getting something later, you know, that's a discussion that you need to have together. And the Association of Oregon Counties, there were some counties that were very enthusiastic about the idea of Multnomah and Marion stepping forward with this. We have the populations, I think, that lend themselves to this kind of work. And so we did get the support of the Association of Oregon Counties at their most recent meeting. So we have added that to our flyer that you have. So those are my remarks. I'd be happy to take any questions, and thank you again for listening, and I would urge your support of House Bill 2031 with the -1 amendment.
Thanks. I support this 100%. I think it's a great plan. The one-time dollar, what is that ask?
The amount is
$1 million.
Let me make sure I have the right amount here.
And we're waiting for a fiscal impact. So
right.
Well, so it's just under $1 million.
Right, $998,700.
Okay, thank you.
And that's for 18 months of the 2015-17 biennium. So it's calculated on an average daily population rate and the cost that it has for a caseworker to go in those homes and do those intensive services, which are multiple times a week and a 24/7
right. Gotcha.
Operation.
Understood.
So it's very intensive.
Thank
and
you.
That's for both counties.
Right, for Multnomah.
Oh,
and
okay.
Yeah,
excellent.
That's,
thank
that's,
you.
Right. That's the entire.
Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair Kinnegar. My hat's off to you. This is one of the most elegant pieces of legislation I've seen in the first two or three weeks, and I really think this is, you know, a modern 21st century government needs to do this sort of thing, where you have a good idea, a hypothesis, and instead of rolling it out statewide with a multi-million dollar project, you do a targeted pilot study. With a, hopefully a well-defined hypothesis and good evaluation scheme at the end, so you can really learn some lessons. And I encourage you, the only one thing that I encourage you to look at is make sure your populations are as similar as possible. That may be hard, and if you don't have them match up, then I'm concerned about the validation of your conclusions. So as much as possible, make sure those populations are equivalent. So, but great work.
Thank you. And Chair Kinnegar, if I could respond, and Representative Buehler, thank you for those comments. We will be working with the Oregon Youth Authority on the evaluation components, and they have great researchers there, and we'll be helping with us with that. Really, what we're looking at in Marion and Multnomah County is that we have disproportionate minority populations in Multnomah County, and both our juvenile directors are here, and so they'll speak to this with a lot more detail than I can, but there are a number of African-American youth in Multnomah County that are involved in the system. In Marion County, we have the highest highest number of Latino youth. So we may not have the same populations per se, but you will see cultural barriers, gang affiliations, the other types of issues that you saw on that slide that Fairbourn's had before you.
Chair Kenegar, thank you. Wonderful program, and I have signed on as a, you know, support of this bill. I do have a question on what you anticipate as far as getting the in-home services consent from the parents, as we what saw on the slide there, that some of these parents may not be, you know, ideal situations, and of course that's what you're trying to go in and help with. But have you looked at how many of these homes you can get consent to go in, and is there an incentive built in for the parents to cooperate?
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Hayden, that's an excellent question. That I, again, it's the provider of the services that has been working with us, has done several presentations to our Public Safety Council and so on. And while I can't answer the question for them, what I can say is that they very much connect with the family on every level. So it's not something that they feel like is done to them, it's something that is done with them. And so I think between the juvenile department folks, because the youth is involved, and if the youth doesn't do this in-home service, then they're going to have some other mechanism that they're going to have to go through. So it's not kind of a choice of do you do this or not. It's a choice if you do you have in-home services, or do you place the youth in OIA, or place the youth in residential, okay, or that type of thing. So I'm just hypothesizing in terms of how the consent process works, because I can't answer that question. But I do know that the engagement with the families was just very impressive in the data that we saw and the presentations that we had.
And I think also what will help with that too is it is a pilot program, and so not all of the offenders will be put into this program. So it could very well be that if a family just is so against it, obviously, you know,
it wouldn't be part of the program.
Exactly. So hopefully we'll get to the parents that are really wanting it, and we'll see the benefit from that, and then work our way into that and so on. So since it is a pilot program, I don't think that that's going to be a huge issue.
Follow up?
Sure.
So am I hearing I'm almost hearing it's voluntary, but as an incentive to, is it completely voluntary or is it not completely voluntary?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I'm going to defer that question to Faye Fagel and Christina McMahon when they come up to talk about how the process works, because they actually have experience implementing this. And again, this I'm getting outside my pay grade here in terms of trying to answer that question. Thank you.
Representative Parrish, you want to ask this panel?
Yeah, I do, actually. Specifically, Janet, thank you for presenting this. I appreciate it. And I'm curious. So you have somebody who's an offender, youth offender, who would qualify for sort of, you know, deep wraparound in-home type services under this. What about siblings? I mean, usually what happens is we have a situation, and I've grown up and lived through this situation, where you've got a sibling who's an offender, and younger siblings typically underneath that person who are sort of exposed to all of this. What are the supports that you envision in a pilot program that actually will address the issue around sort of building in some supports to siblings so that, one, they understand what's going on, particularly for younger siblings? I think that's a huge issue. And then, two, maybe the investment of some dollars of a you know, that might be attached to a kiddo that actually help with some preventative for younger siblings to keep them off of a path that an older sibling might wind up on or is on.
And Madam Chair, Representative Parrish, that is exactly what this program is designed to do. So you've hit the nail right on the head. So you have older siblings that are involved in a family dynamic. You have younger siblings that are on the same trajectory or are experiencing other issues. Because the in-home services treats the entire family, the siblings are included in that. So they're not just looking at a youth individually, they're looking at a youth and parents and a youth and other family members. So all of that's part of the project, and it does exactly what you just described. It helps prevent those issues from appearing in those youth if they can get a handle around the family and change the dynamic, because the way the parents are interacting with the youth that's in trouble is the same, those same issues they you would see in terms of the parental interaction with the younger siblings. So by being able to work on supervision issues and on the communication issues, all of the other important things that make for a strong and healthy family, you're able to work in that mode with all of the family members.
Can I follow up? Sure. And I'm assuming in this sort of the delivery of services, we're talking about not just sort of the correction service of, hey, you need to get your life back on track, but also, you know, how do we make sure that, I mean, this is typically a population that is not attending school or struggling to have, you know, proper connection to education, population that tends to have significant health care issues, both preventative and somewhere in the middle of unmet health care needs. So does this sort of take that approach that we're going to look at the child and siblings as sort of a whole family, whole issue type approach? Because if some of those needs are going unmet in the process like this, I'm going to assume that the opportunity to succeed is actually not as high as we'd like it to be.
Madam Chair and Representative Parrish, yes, they will be looking at all of the different social issues, health issues, those types of things with that family. If you look on the flyer that we provided, the outcomes that Youth Villages of Oregon has demonstrated, they measure particularly whether youth are living at home or independently, whether they're in school, graduated, earned a GED, and they have no further involvement with the law. They are involved, they see up to about 4 days a week with the family, which is very intensive, and then on call 24/7. So if there's a crisis at 2 o'clock in the morning, they're coming. They assign one person to be with that family, so they're not seeing multiple people. So a lot of these things are built into the system. So whether they refer them to these other services or make sure they get to appointments or whatever, I mean, that is, they're just involved with that family to stabilize that child and also to restructure that family dynamic so that it moves forward in a constructive way.
Thank you.
I was just going to follow on your comment about siblings. I was thinking the same thing, and hopefully part of the pilot is to look at not just those 51 kids, but their sibling outcomes compared to the others. Is it actually the Intercept program? Is this model actually the Intercept, or is it just like Intercept?
Representative Kenny Geyer, the way that the bill is structured, it asks the Oregon Youth Authority to select through a competitive process a provider to provide the services.
Okay.
And so certainly we can't presuppose that any particular nonprofit will be successful in that bidding process.
Okay.
However, the presentations we've had have been from Youth Villages of Oregon. They have a demonstrated track record in this and are very supportive of the bill.
So I don't know if any of you saw the when Youth Villages had their program here in January, they had a young woman who had gone through this program. Did you see this? Who was very, very powerful, incredible speaker. And this had really changed her life, and she had relapsed and yet was able to build herself back. It was very, very powerful. Representative Buehler.
I don't know if it's helpful, but Youth Villages has received a significant grant to do an Intercept trial project in Deschutes County. Huh? Since it's already funded, maybe you could increase your numbers by using some of those patients. So something just to look into. So.
That's great.
Does not surprise me.
Well, another follow-up, you know, and of course a lot of my experience is anecdotal, but what about like incentive metrics for these kids? So what types of sort of carrots are put in front of them that when you get, you know, when you've had success, like what are we delivering to those kids in terms of, I mean, obviously you're going to stay out of, you know, some sort of lockup type situation, but which is hopefully an incentive, but not always. And so what other types of incentives are you sort of, are you thinking about maybe putting into a system like this in terms of sort of rewarding behavior and helping kids change? Because I, you know, I've got three teen and preteen kids, and incentives are important, particularly in those ages.
And Representative Parrish, I, again, I'm not the provider of the service, so
okay.
Probably would not be, I'm not recalling from the presentation them talking about incentives. My guess is that certainly if they get the kind of outcomes that they're getting, that
they're doing something.
They're doing something
okay.
Right.
So. Thank you.
So I want to thank this panel. Thank you. We're very delighted to have new representatives who are really passionate about this. And I know Commissioner Carlson has been involved in the County Commission on Children and Prevention and Early Childhood Hubs and Youth all the way through for your entire career. So it's great that you've joined forces on us. Thank you so much.
Very much.
Thank you.
And so now I'd like to call up Faye Fagel. And is there somebody else also? Please join us. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Christina McMahon. I am the Multnomah County Juvenile Services Division Director, and I'm actually here wearing two hats. I'll cover the other hat real briefly. I'm also a member of the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, and today they voted unanimously to support House Bill 2031. So I just wanted to share that with you. The other part of that hat is while I'm in Multnomah County, I've been here for 3.5 years. Prior to Multnomah County, I've actually worked in three other counties in the juvenile justice system in the state of Oregon. I started my career in Marion County as a juvenile prosecutor, then went to Deschutes County as a prosecutor in the juvenile area, and then changed careers and went down to Douglas County as the juvenile department director. Wow. And then went up to Multnomah. So I am very excited about this bill because of the potential opportunities that it could bring to youth in the entire state of Oregon. Again, if the results are what we hope they are. So I just wanted to say that. From a Multnomah County perspective, we are in a little bit of a different situation. We are actually have been for the last a little more than 2 years been doing a pilot with that involved intensive in-home services. Specifically, we've contracted with Youth Villages of Oregon. So I think maybe I can shed a light on some of the questions that were raised here today by committee members. But before I get into that, I really want to take a moment to thank the leadership of the Oregon Youth Authority that's here today, specifically Director Pax Suresh, Deputy Director Joe O'Leary, and Assistant Director Phil Cox, who are here in the back of the room. They have partnered with us in Multnomah County in November. We actually signed an agreement to start a very small pilot that will end June 30th of 2015 that provided additional funding so that we could expand our pilot with Youth Villages. We haven't had the ability to do this on a big scale, and so as you know from the questions about data, you need to have a big enough N to be able to measure. So they're helping us get a larger N, but we're still not where we need to be. But that partnership that we entered into this fall was really a reflection of our mutual commitment to helping the youth of Multnomah County who have some specific and unique needs compared to other parts of the state. I think from my background, I kind of have a perspective on some of the differences. There are some things that unite all kids. They all have the different risk factors that Director Pax Suresh put up on his slide when he was going through all the different variables. We see those in all the counties in Oregon. But in Multnomah County, we have a specific challenge with providing culturally responsive services for youth of color in our county. We have a very high rate of youth who end up penetrating the system deeper, whether that's going to a youth correctional facility bed. Approximately 70% of the kids who went from Multnomah County last year were youth of color, or whether it's getting a Measure 11 and penetrating the adult system. So it's a significant issue. It has a lot of challenges with finding providers that can be culturally responsive and really meet families where they're at to provide them services. So we've had about 25 youth who've completed the INTERCEPT model, the intensive home-based program that we've been using. And of those 25 youth, we have approximately 10 that are in right now, thanks to the funding that we've received through the Oregon Youth Authority for this year. But of the 25 that have finished, Approximately 72% of them were youth of color, and we've only had two youth that ended up going on to a youth correctional facility bed. So I think that's an important thing to note, because the youth that we've placed in this pilot program are youth who are medium to high risk of reoffending. So when I say high risk, I mean high risk to commit another crime. So to have that kind of success, it's not a big enough N to say that this is the answer, but it is a really good indicator, and we're hoping that through this pilot that's being proposed in 2031, we can get an answer about whether or not this is a model that makes sense for Oregon to look at on a bigger scale. Some of the questions that were raised about family engagement, I just wanted to say it is a voluntary service. In Multnomah County, about 4 years ago, we adopted a completely different way of managing our probation cases. We adopted a model called functional family probation, which is working very in a strength-based and respectful way with families, primarily in their homes. We learned about the Intercept model and thought, wow, this is an option that could really match well with what we're trying to do from the correctional standpoint of how we work with families. But with that being said, when you approach families and it's with a hammer, that doesn't typically work very well. And as a parent of a six-year-old who I hope never ends up in the system, I know now that that's changed my worldview about how we should interact with families that are involved in the juvenile justice system, because their voice shouldn't be a sideline consideration. It should be a central part of why we do what we do, because that connection is what helps kids. All the research tells us is what helps kids to be successful. So in our county, we have it set up as a voluntary service. We don't court order families and youth to be involved in the Intercept model. But what we have found is that the combination of the trained family intervention specialists that work for youth villages and our juvenile court counselors who have training also with working with families, but their job is to really make sure that the court orders are met. They work collaboratively, and they're able to get a very high level of engagement from families on a voluntary basis. And sometimes it takes several attempts. It isn't always a first meeting where the families will agree to do it, but that's the commitment that our department and the provider have is what makes the difference. I think we've only had five or six families that have refused to do youth villages. And we've had some that have refused to do it initially and then have called us back and said, we know that this could help us. We want to give it a try. Mm-hmm. So I think that's our approach. I'm not saying every other county would view it that way. So that's an important piece. In terms of the incentives and what does youth villages use, once again, that collaboration between the juvenile department personnel and the providers is critical. We have some resources, we have some incentives that we use, but they've also developed a whole bunch of things. Like, for example, they've developed through their work with foundations and private donors the ability to get almost every kid who's involved with them into a summer camp opportunity that taps into something that individual child is interested in. That's a really important piece. When you can tap into something positive that a young person can grow from and feel a sense of accomplishment from, that's really a positive. So I don't want to take up all the time. Ms. Fagel has some wonderful things to share with you, but I just wanted to share the Multnomah perspective from having dipped our toe into this water a little bit and have had some successful experiences. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them after. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Faye Fagel, and I'm the juvenile director for Marion County. I've given you some written testimony, and I've had lots of comments that I was going to make, but a lot of people have already made them, so I'm not going to duplicate those comments. I agree with everything that was said, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I just want to make a couple comments, some of the questions that folks had asked, and that is one that, you know, we deal with youth and families that have very complex needs and challenges, and the criminal behavior that we see is often not the first or the primary issue and is not the first sign of trouble within the family. And so we have youth that have long histories starting at an early age of disengagement, disconnection with the community, with their schools, with the support systems that provide for success. And so when they actually become involved in criminal activity, that's way after a whole number of things have occurred. And so I think that's important to note. The other is that we recognize that these youth need to have some consequences, but if we don't address the family functioning, then the youth is back in chaos. And so, you know, I've been in the working in this field since 1975, and the model, well, we'll just remove you from the home and then everything will work out great, you know, we found out early on is not a good model, because no matter what kind of family system a youth comes from, family is very strong. And so our kids tend to be connected to their families no matter what, no matter what's happened to them in their family. They still want to have a family, and the importance of that. So what we found is that if we actually can create a family system that's healthy and have that youth be in that family system for a longer period of time, we have much better rates of success with those youth. The other issue is the generational concerns. And so we see that parents often come from similar family dynamics that they're recreating. And so having the opportunity then to work with that family to make some changes then allows for generational change with their youth then not recreating the family systems that they came from. The other thing that I wanted to say is that the parents that we deal with for the most part really, really love and care about their kids. Mm-hmm. And so this kind of idea about how do you get them to engage in services, I think the issue with engaging in services is it's very tough to be in a position where someone says, your family's kind of screwed up, do you want to sit down and let's talk to you about how screwed up your family is? And so that's very scary for people to have to come in. It's scary for us to have to go talk to somebody about those things that are not working for us. And so how we engage with the family around their care and concern for their youth and trying to help and support them to address those things that they can identify that are not working within their family. And that's part of this model, is the idea that families can self-identify some of the concerns that they have about how their family is working. But the basic underlying thing is that they really do care about their youth, and they really want they want to be in a healthy family, but many of them don't know how to make that happen, and they want their youth to be successful. And so when we're able to work with them to help them to know that we have that same goal for their youth, then families want to engage in that process. The comment has been made that in Marion County, we, as Commissioner Carlson said, do have the largest Hispanic Latino population that's in our juvenile justice system, and so that is a focus for us, is creating some wraparound services to help address the concerns and issues from those families and support the success of those youth.
Faye, if you have just maybe a concluding comment, because we're bumping up, and I want
to
make sure that if there is any question that people have an opportunity to ask.
I think, just understanding that there's a lot of trauma that comes around in these families and that happens early on, and chaotic family systems. And so the opportunity that we have to be able to address that, as Commissioner Carlson said, within the context of the family is really the best focus. And this isn't for all youth. There are youth that still need the residential programs. There are still youth that need to be placed in youth correctional facilities. But it creates another piece of the continuum within the juvenile justice system. So thank you very much for your support.
That's fantastic. Any questions? Last minute questions? Thank you both for your very long service to this area. We started in comparison to your very long service, just talking about today, Representative Stark and I started out in the Human Services Subcommittee talking about how do you get the intellectual and developmental disability community back into community services. I know that I have several bills working with mental health and adolescents and really trying to involve their families more, particularly at that stage of discharge from ER or acute care. So this is, I think, a growing theme. Thank you so much for being on the front end of it. It's very exciting, and I'm hoping that whatever kind of technical amendments you need to make, you get them back to us quickly. I think there's a lot of enthusiasm.
Great. Here. Thank you very much for your support.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So with that, I'm going to close the if anyone has any questions, maybe you can stay after and talk to OYA, but at this point I'm going to close the public hearing on 2131. At our next meeting, which will take place this Friday, February 20th, we'll have a public hearing on House Bill 2232,
and work sessions on House Bill 2442, that's the Housing and Community Services, and consider the Dash 3 amendments for that, as well as House Bill 2610, and consider the Dash 1 amendment for that. That's the farm worker bill that we've been waiting for, the fiscals forever. So cool. Any other announcements? Okay, we are adjourned.